Welcome to this special edition of the Active Photographer Podcast, your behind-the-scenes glimpse into the day-to-day life of a working professional photographer, with me, Giles Babbage. I've put together these Focus Extra shows, in addition to the regular weekly podcasts, in order to bring you all the conversations I recorded live at Focus on Imaging 2012. There's a lot to get through, so each recording will lead straight into the next. In this edition, I'm talking with the Royal Photographic Society, Black Rapid Camera Straps, and Sigma Lenses and Cameras. As ever, you can check out all the show notes to this and all other shows at theactivephotographer.com. At last year's Focus on Imaging, I was stood on the Black Rapid stand and I was talking to a lovely lady called Lorraine Lobdell. Now, Lorraine is no longer with Black Rapid. She's out there. She's doing her excellent Photo Sister project, which goes from strength to strength. But I have been told that I need to speak to Mark Gotula. There we go. Mark is the director of sales at Black Rapid, and we're just going to have a chat at what's been going on in the last sort of 12 months with Black Rapid, and what we're looking at, really. So, Mark, where do we start?
Well, where we start is that we have finally come out with a few accessory items for the straps that gives the sports strap a bag that you can actually put up on it now, so you can take your cell phone, your flash cards, your batteries, extra batteries, and that was a huge deal with a lot of the photographers that had bought the sports strap. From there, we basically brought out the same bag for all of the other straps, the DR1 RS7 as well.
Excellent. And I think that the whole modular system, the fact that people can upgrade and add to their existing their system is a great thing. Now, regular listeners will know that I use two of your straps. So I have the one that's over my shoulder at the moment, which is the Sport. Yeah.
Yes.
And I've got the, I always forget the name of it, but the double strap, which is the DR1.
DR1, yep. Yes.
God, I must be learning. How about that?
Yeah, you are.
But, you know, joking aside, when it comes to walking around with two cameras, especially, with Lorraine, we had this conversation last year. So many times you've had a crisscross of straps across your shoulders and your chest. It's not a good look, and it's not a practical solution. For those that are not aware of the double strap, can we just talk about that, for example?
Of course. With this strap, you're basically keeping the person from having to do what I call the chicken, which is where you're flopping your arms up to keep the two cameras positioned on your shoulders. Because it's set on both shoulders and then connected both front and back, you're able to then take the weight of whatever cameras you want to carry and make it just disappear.
And listeners will know that I shoot certain events through the year, which I'm on my feet for 3 days non-stop, and it really does make a hell of a difference. Now, I typically work with an 80 to 200 on a D3, and then I'll have another body with a 24-85, something like that. The balance is where the issue comes, and how you keep the balance between those two cameras. So, you guys, I know that you have
the bumper systems, where you can then take whichever camera you're not using and be able to, you have a bumper in back and a bumper in front, and you can take the front bumper back and pin the camera behind you so that it's not in the way, so you have access to the other side and be able to use it without having the other camera influencing.
And that's the thing, you're always literally running around to get into position, and you don't want your cameras flying at all angles and what have you. For a lot of people, of course, they're not going to be shooting on D3s, they're not going to be shooting on high-end cameras. Mm-hmm. For those people that are enthusiast photographers, they've got sort of consumer-level cameras, something that's maybe sort of prosumer, sort of low down the lines. What do you have in the range, sort of maybe like the accessory pouches and the gear that's designed at them?
Well, for people who have slightly smaller cameras, We tend to push them toward like an RS7, something that where if they're not running around like a crazed idiot at a photo
like
shoot,
like me, in other words.
you've got the RS7. Mm-hmm. You've got, if you need a pouch already built on, you've got the RS4 and RS5. So it's many different straps to fit different needs. In fact, we have a small bag system for anybody who shoots with a Micro Four Thirds camera.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Or smaller cameras, we have three different bag sling systems called the Snap Bar. So yeah, you've got something that fits your Micro Four Thirds, which is the 35 Snap Bar, and then there's the 20, which fits your G12 Canon size,
okay,
and then there's the Snap Bar 10, which fits something like a S100 Canon or smaller.
So, and presumably all of these straps, they share the same fixing system, which is the carabiner quick release with the connection nut that goes into the base of the camera, stays there, and it's very quick to remove.
Right. All of the bag systems have the same sling action.
It is one of those systems that's been copied a lot. And
yes.
I'm not going to name names. I don't think that's fair. Black Rapid, of course, are by far, you would say, the best. There's certainly...
We certainly build
up
the best
there,
quality,
you know.
Yes.
And I have to admit, not at this year's event, but at last year's Focus, I was walking around, and there are other manufacturers that are out there that I did have a look at their stuff. And they said, well, would you like to try them on? Would you like to have a look? What have you? And you just know, as a photographer, you know immediately whether a product is really not coming up to the mark that it needs to be. For those of you listening that aren't aware of Black Rapid, Mark, give us a website that they should look at.
Sure, it's www.blackrapid.com.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to be linking to that in the show notes, as always. For those of you that want to listen to my conversation with Larray last year, I'll be linking to that as well. Mark, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Good to meet you for the first time this year, and hopefully we'll be in touch soon.
You will. Thanks.
Cheers. So, I'm talking with Michael Pritchard, FRPS, who is the Director General of the Royal Photographic Society. And the RPS is a long-standing institution, which I know a lot of you will be well aware of, but you may not actually know what the RPS does, what it stands for, or indeed how it is moving with these exciting times. So, first of all, Michael, hello.
Hi, good afternoon.
And of course, it sounds very sounds very strange standing here. We've had a conversation already and having the official introduction. But let's start off. Tell me, what is the RPS?
Okay, well, the RPS is really about promoting photography and helping people develop their own photography. And we cover literally everything. We've got a fantastic heritage and history to us, but we're also a very forward-looking organisation. We're very much about contemporary photography as well, and moving into the new areas that photography is moving into itself. So that means things like new media and creating moving images through still DSLR cameras and those sorts of things. So we're very much contemporary and forward-looking, as well as making the best use of that historical heritage that we have.
And that's an interesting point there, because you of course will know, and I must admit my mind's gone blank, when was the RPS founded originally?
Well, we go back nearly 160 years now. We were formed in 1853. Roger Fenton and a few other of those names that we've all read in our history books came together and formed this little group of amateur photographers. And then over the next 150, 160 years, it really grew and developed. And it became known as the parent body, in fact. It was the father, the mother and father of all the photographic societies at various points in its history. And I think my view is it's still very much the premier photographic society throughout the world, really. I think everyone respects what it does, and you know, that every photographer, I think, would like to get the fellowship, which is the ultimate accolade.
Absolutely.
For many.
Absolutely. And of course, the it was founded in Bath, I believe. Was that actually where it was founded, or was that where a lot of people would maybe immediately think of it as being?
I think that people will think of us being a Bath-based society, but actually we were founded in London back in 1853, and for most of the society's life it was based in London. We moved down to Bath in 1979 when we opened a National Centre of Photography, which was an enormous exhibition area, society's headquarters. And that when that finally closed sort of 15 years later, we decided to stay in Bath. We have a good building down there with a lecture theatre and facilities there, and that's where we hold a lot of our workshops and courses, although we do plenty of others throughout the country as well.
So when it comes to those lectures and courses, you alluded to the fact that times change, people are thinking about
digital, obviously. We come to accept it now. Who remembers film? There's a lot of people listening that will probably never have picked up a film camera. But, of course, where do you stand where it comes to the application of video and sort of new video and new media in that sense? Is it something that has been touched upon, or is it too far removed from stills for what the society actually is about?
It's not removed, actually, and I think people that maybe think of the society very much as a still photography society probably may haven't realised that we've always had a long tradition of being involved in film in the moving image, right back to 35mm motion picture film back in 1910, and society, in fact, and some of its pioneers at that time were some of those people that were developing motion pictures. And it's been on our radar, particularly with that move from digital, and the last year or so we've developed a whole new distinctions category, which we're calling multimedia and narrative, which is very much about embracing the moving image, telling a story through perhaps a series of still images, but also very much about telling it through a moving image. It's a development of what, you know, some of our more traditional listeners might think about the old AV type show, the slide sequence, that sort of thing. It's very much the modern version of that, digitally based, and using all of that new technology in modern DSLR, for example, or even through your iPhone.
And do you find, and you touched on it just there, mentioning the iPhone, do you think that technology is more accessible now than, say, the equivalent of, say, 20 years ago?
It is, and I think this is one area where the technology is really helping the photographer. I mean, I think even whether you're a still photographer, I think digital has many advantages, and I know there are discussions we can have around the craft of photography and the darkroom and all of that. I grew up with a darkroom and love that side, but, you know, as a photographer also, digital is still, I think it facilitates things that I would never be able to do through a darkroom. It makes it more convenient, and I think the same is very much with the moving image as well, that there are things that we can do with digital technology through perhaps a DSLR or your iPhone that we'd never have been able to have done through, you know, Super 8, 8mm, you know, motion picture film.
But we were talking just before we started recording about, you know, going back to the days of Fox Talbot, and on the Isle of Wight you've got, of course, Dimbola Lodge with Julie Margaret Cameron over there. And I know that regular listeners will know that when I had a walk around and a chat over at Dimbola, and we talked about the history of the building and what have you, she was a well-to-do lady, and people look at the pictures now and think, well, of course, technology's moved on so much, they're all fuzzy. And I said, she used to deface her lenses to get the soft focus effect. So actually what she was doing in a roundabout way is no different to what we are doing with Photoshop, with movie effects and that sort of thing. I personally think that when digital was the new thing, there was almost a knee-jerk reaction. I think people got very excited and look what we can do that we could never do before. But I think people now have kind of settled down. Would you agree that people are kind of finding what it can do for them personally?
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, actually. I think we need to all understand and realise that digital, it's a means to an end in one sense, but it's very much about allowing you to be creative. Mm. And, you know, whether we're doing it in a dark room, whether we're making daguerreotypes or using wet collodion or film and all of those historic things, you know, digital is really just another way to help us as creative photographers. Mm. And that, to me, is the most important thing. And I think you're right. You know, when it first came out, when, you know, Photoshop 4 was there, you know, people were bringing all these filters and effects in and doing all things that now we look at with horror, really, because it was overused. Mm. And I think you're right, there's been a reaction against that, and I think a lot of photographers, or hopefully most photographers now, are much more considered in how they're using some of those things. And I would hope, and certainly in the society, I think the members are using some of those things in a way that helps them create the photographs that they want to. Mm. And where you're not particularly aware necessarily of the effect or the filter. It's much more about the image, the content of that, and how creative it is. And that's, to me, where digital is a real winner.
And where we're stood here, we're around the back of the of your display here, the RPS stand, because there was a lecture or a seminar talk going on. We've got a load of pictures here on display, and they're dotted around in various places. Let's talk a little bit about the RPS. I alluded to the fact that you've got those magic letters FRPS after your name. For those that don't know the system of the letters, what they stand for, and the process, let's just talk a bit about that.
Okay, well, I mean, the first thing to say is that anyone can be a member of the society. There's no restriction on entry or membership. But a lot of members join the society because they want to get what we call one of our distinctions. So the basic level is a licentiate, and that's very much about having a technical understanding, being able to create technically good, competent photographs across a range of subjects. And then as you move through to the associate, which is the next level up, and then particularly at the fellowship level, there's an acceptance that you understand photography from a technical perspective. It then becomes much more about that creative process. Mm-hmm. And at the very top level, the fellowship, it's very much about creating very distinctive photography. And you know, there's only 700 fellows throughout the world.
Right.
But the associate, what we're looking at the moment is an associateship panel that was taken by one of our members in Yellowstone.
There's some beautiful images.
Yeah, they're fabulous. I mean, there's everything here from wildlife. There's a wolf there, bison in snowy landscapes. There's hot springs, geysers, and landscape work. Mm. So, been taken by a single photographer. He's using a digital camera, so we have no issue with digital as a medium at all. But what he's producing here at the associate level, firstly, it's technically excellent. There's no issues with any of the aspects of the work he's creating from a technical point of view, but it's also creative. He's thinking, he's got an eye for a picture here, and he's able to see an image, to see a picture, whether it's a wolf in a landscape or a landscape itself with trees or clouds coming in. He's able to create a picture, see that, and get it onto paper in a way that, you know, we're looking at now and, you know, think, wow, look at those. I wish, you know, personally as a photographer, I wish I could create something like that.
And you mentioned they're getting them onto paper, which just shows how it shows your background that we used to print onto paper. You know, are you finding that I would imagine with the society people have a better appreciation and understanding, but certainly so many people, they will have these wonderful cameras, but they never actually print any of their work, and then they go to tatters when their hard drive breaks. They haven't backed up even onto discs, onto, you know, regular CDs. How much do you put an emphasis on people about printing their work to show it? Because at the end of the day, that's what pictures are for. They're there to be seen.
They are, and I think, in fairness, I think that's a very much down to the individual. I think there's some statistic that 97% of digital photographs never, ever get printed. They only ever stay on the memory card or in the camera. As a society, we organise exhibitions, we organise competitions, and most of those we ask for paper submissions printed on paper. But we're realistic to know that some people just want to create images digitally. So we also produce exhibitions which are just digital, so that they go around to camera clubs or to exhibition sites on CD or as virtual exhibitions, if you like. But I mean, I have to say personally, you can't really beat seeing a good quality print on a wall in a gallery or in an exhibition space. So you can actually go up and look at it really closely. I think just for me, that's always going to be the real benchmark of a good photographer.
And there was also, where was I reading? There, again, another statistic that this saying essentially this is the lost generation, you know, that in years to come so many people won't have printed their work, that the technology which they're using even to store the pictures will become obsolete, that there'll be no way to view. But we are constantly hearing of images being found in people's attics, in old suitcases, that okay, they might be a bit faded and a bit rough around the edges, but those that have been, relatively speaking, you know, looked after, they stand the test of time.
They do, and I think you're right. Look, the idea of a lost generation, I think, is a very real concern. That the last 160 odd years of photography, there's been usually been something tangible there, prints, and generally, unless they physically get destroyed or burnt, then they generally survive, and we can look at them today and do things with them. I think the digital world is changing that, and I'm not sure that someone finding a memory card in the back of a drawer in 100 years' time is ever going to be able to do anything with that. And it's a real big issue for archives, and places like the National Gallery and the British Library are looking at this very seriously, because they realise that unless they do something, unless they archive that material in a form that will be accessible, then images and paper records, you know, whether it's from government or books, will be just disappear. There won't be any way to get that information and data out. So, yeah, I think as photographers, I think we have a responsibility to make sure that at least some of our work does end up on paper, so it will survive for the next 100 or 200 years.
And I think I'm as guilty as the next person. I'm always being told off at home for not printing out my own pictures. It's one thing to shoot commissioned work, but when you're just taking pictures of your friends, family and what have you, and you're not printing them out, I've got no excuse, because I should know as well as anyone.
Well,
importance.
So, me too as well. I mean, I'm as bad as everyone else. Yeah. Most of my images stay on a card, or occasionally will end up in print or something. So it does end up on paper eventually, but it's, you know, it's got a screen on it. It's in a printed form rather than a proper photographic print. And yeah, I think you're probably reminding me that I need to do something about it as well.
And I think on that bombshell, I think we'll wrap things up there. I think if people want to take next steps and find out a bit more about the Royal Photographic Society, obviously I'll be linking in the show notes to the RPS site, which, if you'd like to mention that now.
Yep, the RPS website is at www.rps.org.
It's right there, and as I'm sure all the information's there, all the process of getting your letters after your name, if that's what you're after, if that's a challenge, because it is a challenge, and that's part of the fun.
It's a real achievement, and anyone that does get those letters should be very proud of that achievement. But if you don't find what you want on the website, email me, michael@rps.org. Very happy to help and give assistance.
Lovely. Michael, thank you very much for your time today. At last year's Focus on Imaging, it had been on my list to catch up with the lovely people at Sigma, and that didn't quite happen for one reason or another, but very thankfully I've now managed to catch up with Paul Reynolds, who is PR and press manager with Sigma, and it's the end of a pretty long third day now?
Yeah.
So I apologise in advance if the lady on the tannoy makes her announcements clear in the fullness of time. But what I want to talk about with Paul is the fact that I use Sigma lenses, and have done for years, alongside my Nikon lenses. The lens that I use at the moment is the 10-20 EX lens, I believe, which is a razor sharp lens, and I defy anyone not to at least sort of give it a go if they are in the market to look at that. So Paul, what have we got in front of us here? We've got a range of items that we're going to talk about.
Yeah, okay, well, keeping with the theme of SLR lenses, as you mentioned, the 10-20, we'll start with the 180mm. This is a new lens. We haven't actually received them in the UK as production samples yet, so I've got a pre-production here. It's a 180mm 2.8 macro. It's the fifth macro lens that we've got, starting at 50, 70, 105, 150, and now the 180. It does 1-to-1 macro reproduction. It's got a high-speed autofocus HSM motor, and also an optical stabilizer built into the lens as well. Availability we don't know just yet, and same with the price. We haven't had a price announced, so more details still to come on that. But
it is a lovely looking lens, and I mean, you've got the tripod collar built in, obviously.
That's right, yeah.
It's a nice weight of lens as well. It's one of those things, I think, with lenses, there's almost a bit of snobbery. A lot of enthusiasts look at lenses on front of cameras, and if they think, oh, that's a photographer, and oh, wait, it hasn't got Nikon or whatever on it. I'm of the view, as my listeners will know, I don't feel the need to have the latest and the best. If my clients are happy, if I'm happy, that's what matters. With this lens, how much... Who is this lens aimed at, first of all?
Primarily wildlife photographers, nature mm-hmm. photographers. If you do insects photography or butterfly photography, it's perfect for them, because whilst you can still get very close and do full frame butterflies or insects, you've got a bit of a working distance. So anything that might fly away, this is great, because you can just stand a little bit further back, and you're less likely to scare them away. So.
And do you think that it's going to be most popular with enthusiast photographers? Or, I mean, I know that they are high ends now, lenses.
Yeah, these are high end lenses. As I say, we don't know a price yet, but I imagine it's going to be very enthusiast, advanced pro photographers that will be buying this.
And I think that's the thing. If you look at the equivalent prices out there, prices are always going to be cheaper online or in special deals in the high street and what have you. I'm of the view that as long as the kit is up to the job and is rugged, I say that the 10 to 20 I've got it's taken a few knocks, I have to say, but it keeps on going. It's quiet, the mechanisms, but of course not everyone is going to be shooting macro or that's not their discipline. What else have we got in front of us? We've got another lens here.
Yeah, we've got two new lenses actually in a market which we haven't been in before. It's the Micro Four Thirds / Sony E-mount market. Now, as I say, we're starting to get into this. We've got here a 19mm f2.8 and also a 30mm f2.8. The 30mm is currently available in the Micro Four Thirds, and we should be getting the 19mm in about maybe three weeks' time for Micro Four Thirds, and Sony E-mount, hopefully not too long, maybe a month or two. We should get them both.
And I think that's quite interesting because there's always been this thing that, you know, have always been manufacturers out there that are, third party, own brand, whatever, that produce lenses. I've always known that Sigma are essentially the best, or if not one of the best. And they're only, without naming names, they're only in most people's minds top two, possibly three, and Sigma very, very nearly always would be what people would say is top of the line there. How do you, presumably, when a manufacturer brings out, or the industry brings out a new system, it falls to you. Do you feel that it makes sense to, or you feel obliged to embrace that new development to produce new products that are going to fit in with it?
Yeah, well, it certainly makes sense to bring out new products that fit in with it. The compact system camera market has just exploded. So many people are buying into that market now. And Sigma have waited quite a long time before making the decision to get into it. We've got two lenses now. I'm sure that range will grow over time. It's inevitable, I think. But definitely. I mean, the market's there. It's not going to go away, and we should be a part of it. Absolutely. Yep.
I mean, that lens you've got there is very compact. I mean, even by small lens standards, it is pretty tiny.
It's very tiny. Yes, it looks at home on a compact camera for sure. But the whole point of a compact system camera is being compact.
A clue in the name,
If we had an SLR size lens, it wouldn't be quite so good on such a small camera. It might look a bit funny, and the balance wouldn't be so good and things. So yes, it's important to make the lens small. And of course, generally the sensors are smaller as well, which means the optical blocks can be smaller because the amount of light coming through doesn't need to be quite so big.
And you also mentioned their balance, which is something that a lot of people don't necessarily immediately think of. If you have DSLRs with any lens on there, a lot of people find that they're lovely cameras, lovely lenses, but if you're not using, say, an additional battery grip, the balance goes all wrong. If you're not using that, I mean, you obviously listen to your customers, you test products, you know, put the feedback into production, into prototypes. How much emphasis goes into how the lens sits in the hand? And obviously with longer lenses, you have to put a tripod collar on there so that the lens actually gets mounted. For those that don't know, a tripod collar enables you to mount the lens to the tripod rather than the camera, because otherwise, there's the lady with the voice. So the lens collar allows you to mount the lens directly, so that then what you're doing is actually taking the pressure and the stress off of the lens mount on the camera itself. So how much do you actually look at how the lens fits in the hand and how it balances with various cameras?
It's actually quite a difficult thing to do because different cameras weigh different amounts. Top of the range cameras tend to be much heavier. They're metal bodied, they include more features, and they are heavier. They often have big heavy battery grips on the bottom. Whereas perhaps the lower end cameras, if I can say that, are much lighter. They might be plastic bodies. So it's not the easiest thing to do. But we put a lot of effort into making the balance feel as good as we can. But there's always got to be a compromise because it's not designed for one camera. It's designed for lots of different cameras. And being a third party manufacturer, lots of different manufacturers' cameras as well.
Sure.
Not just one range. It's different manufacturers.
But then we bring it in-house, as it were, and what we've got in front of us here are a couple of cameras. One is an SLR. Let's talk of that first of all. This is a Sigma camera.
This is the Sigma cameras. Yeah, we're known certainly for our lenses, but we also produce cameras as well and have been doing so for some time now. This new SLR we've got is called an SD1 Merrill. We've had an SD1 camera for about a year. It's just been replaced by the SD1 Merrill. Very similar features. Price point on this is about £1,800 in the UK. They've literally just landed into the UK, so they're available now. The major selling point is the image sensor that's inside the camera. It's a 46 megapixel sensor. And it's a fovean sensor, so it's made up by three layers, red, green, and blue. And each layer picks up the full spectrum of colour. Each pixel picks up the full spectrum of colour, so you get red, green and blue at every single pixel location. Whereas a Beyer sensor, which you'll find in every other SLR, or compact even, only picks up one wavelength of light, one colour, and the other two are guessed at by surrounding pixels. So that results in sharper images. You don't need the jiggery-pokery, should we say, that goes into guessing the colour and the information that should be there.
So at 46 megapixels, of course, around this time everyone's kind of talking about the D800 Nikon, which is a 36 megapixel. For a lot of people, this is going to be a real alternative. Because, I mean, for one thing, the range of your lenses is totally comparable. You've got such a long product line that the lenses are designed specifically to complement the cameras and vice versa. It's all right there. What's this other camera that we've got alongside here?
This one here is called a DP1 Merrill, and we've also got a DP2 Merrill as well. It's in earlier stages of production than the SLRs. These are just non-working prototypes at the moment. But they actually include the same image sensor that's in the SLR. So again, it's a 46 megapixel APS-C size sensor. Now, if you're here, you can see the pictures we've got on the walls printed at A1 size, and the quality is just stunning. People are staggered that you're going to be able to get those pictures from a compact camera. But you really can, and 46 million pixels is enough. It's more than enough. You don't really need it.
Well, see, we haven't got time now to go into the pixel debate, because if anyone wants to know what all the fuss is about, is bigger better, is more better, go online, have a look, and you'll find... Well, you will find what you want to believe, shall we say. It's too late in the day to be having that discussion. But... certainly, just looking back to the lenses, just to round things off, what is the range of lenses in terms of focal length that if people are shooting on DSLRs, where do we start and where do we go in the product line?
In the Sigma product line, we start at a 4.5mm fisheye and go all the way up to an 800mm telephoto, with pretty much everything you can possibly want in between. So there's a lot of lenses now.
And there's also now what you've got a new zoom telephoto zoom, haven't you? Something like is it a 180 to 500 or something? Or it may not be exactly new, but it's a very popular lens with people.
We do a 120 to 300, which is reasonably new. That's an optically stabilised lens. That's a very, very good quality lens. It has the quality of a prime lens, which is unusual in a zoom, because people generally think that primes are a little bit sharper, and they tend to be right. We do a 200 to 500. I don't know if that's the one you're thinking.
It could
that's
be.
The big one at the end.
I must... Yeah, I mean,
that's not the popular lens.
No. I mean, this.
£16,000.
Well, yeah, this is. I'll take a picture and maybe put up on Facebook. It's an incredible looking lens. It's not your average bird spotter lens. But the point being, so I'm a little bit rusty on exactly what is in your range. But the point, guys, is if you are looking for a lens to replace an existing lens, or if you're looking to try a different type of photography and you want to get decent quality glass that doesn't break the bank, Sigma do have a huge range of lenses. And the lady has finished speaking, so I can now ask Paul to give us a link to your website.
Yeah, it's www.sigma-imaging-uk.com, and all the information's on there. So.
That's excellent. Well, as always, you guys, if you've listened to the other recordings from the show, you'll know I say this every time. I'm going to be linking in the show notes, so if you haven't got a pen and paper handy, just go to the show notes for this edition, and you'll be able to click straight on through. So, Paul, just remains for me to say thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure, thank you.
And hopefully the show is going really well for you guys. We've got another day left. I know my feet are starting to feel the strain of it. But, yeah, thanks for taking the time to speak to us, and we'll catch up soon.
Thank you.
Cheers. Remember, you can check out all the show notes to this and other Focus on Imaging specials, as well as the regular weekly shows, at theactivephotographer.com. If you'd like to get in touch directly, don't forget, I'm on Twitter, at Giles Babbage. There's the Facebook page, facebook.com/theactivephotographer. Or, of course, send me a good old-fashioned email, giles@theactivephotographer.com. So thanks for listening, everyone. Take care, and I will speak to you all very soon.